Hi, I'm Kimberly Rogers, and you're listening to the Torah portion for June 24th and 25th, 2011, from sundown to sundown. This teaching is brought to you by themessianicmessage.com. I hope that you enjoy this message. Korah, it's Numbers 16, starting in verse 1 to 18, verse 32. 1 Samuel chapter 11, starting at verse 14, going to chapter 12, verse 22, and the Brit Hadashah is Romans 13, 1 to 7. Korach, which is the Hebrew pronunciation of it, is a very special Torah portion, not just because it reveals how not to approach God's anointed, but because it teaches us just how special God's anointed are to him. Now, we all know the story of Korah by now, most of us anyway. Korah, after seeing all of the things that had come before, you know, the giving of the Torah, the building of the tabernacle, witnessing the miracles of God in the desert, I mean, even bringing the entire assembly out of Egypt altogether and saving them all at the Red Sea, and how he fed them, and how he took care of them and protected them with the pillars of cloud and fire. And then, witnessing the idolatry with the golden calf and God's reaction to that, and witnessing the constant complaining and God's reaction to that, and witnessing the disobedience of the 10 men who returned with a bad report and God's reaction to that, after all that, you would think that there would be no one left in the assembly that didn't have a clue about messing with God. But oh no, here comes Korach and his attitude. And what was his attitude? Moses, Moses, you take too much on yourself. Now how condescending can that be? I'm telling you, if I was Moses, I would have been pitching a fit. But of course, Moses fell on his face, and I'm going to explain about that a little bit later. Korach and his 250 men ended up dead in a sinkhole. But the very next day, what happens? The whole assembly rises up against Moses and Aaron. Not just a few men, but the whole assembly. And for the umpteenth time, God tells Moses he just wants to kill them all. And he does kill some of them. He kills, 14,700 of them. But that's where this Torah portion begins, because there is so much beyond the telling of this stiff-necked misbehavior in here. This teaching of Korah actually sets the stage for us to understand some very important things about the priesthood. Now, the first thing we want to notice is Moses and Aaron's reaction to all this. Each time that they were threatened, they fell on their faces before God. Now, this is the proper way to approach God when there's a disaster. On the face, immediately. Getting on your face is a posture of worship. Now, this would have been the posture taken by Job. 43 times in Scripture, we are told of people falling on their faces. Some when they are in the presence of God, others when seeking God, and others when there is a disaster. And people who understood who Yeshua was when he was here walking on the earth also fell on their faces before him. So it would seem that this posture gets God's attention. Yet today, we almost never see this. And like I said earlier, there is something about this for us to learn. There is prophetic significance in this. You see, when we get into the camps of the righteous, we better know how to do this. In fact, it would be a good idea, and I'm talking to me, it would be a good idea for us to learn to get on our literal faces before God before going into the camps. Why? Because we're going to go through these same tests. But this time, God really is in a destructive mood. You know what I mean? Do you know that there are going to be people in our camps that will test God's leadership in the same way that was tested back there about 3,500 years ago? Now, what is our reaction supposed to be? Are we to fight with them, or are we to get on our face before God? You see, I've been kind of going through a personal test with this, and it's interesting that I can see that God is trying to teach me to get on my face before Him when people rise up against me, rather than getting all upset and crying, or getting all upset and hiding, or getting all upset and striking back. I'm to get on my face before Him. And I think that we're all supposed to learn this lesson. Now, I believe that we can rightly suppose that many of us, however, not all of us, will be leaders in the camps. And that as leaders in the camps, we will already have been putting the commandments into practice in our lives. That's why we will be leaders in the camps. Now, if you've been doing that, then you might well find yourself in the position of some kind of leadership during that time, during the tribulation. Now, let me tell you, how we respond to the tests is going to be just as important as the tests themselves. Now, let's see what else happens in the assembly. Well, after the plague that Aaron stops by running to get ahead of it with his censer with burning incense in it, the people say this. In Numbers 17:13, everyone who comes near to the tabernacle of the Lord shall die. Are we all to perish? And then in Numbers 18:1-2, so the Lord said to Aaron, you and your sons and your father's house with you shall bear iniquity connected with the sanctuary, and you and your sons with you shall bear iniquity connected with your priesthood, and with you bring your brothers also, the tribe of Levi, the tribe of your father, that they may join you and minister to you while you and your sons with you are before the tent of the testimony. Now, wait a minute. At the last verse in chapter 17, the people asked, are we all going to perish? And in the very next verse, the Lord just starts talking to Aaron. He didn't even answer them. Or did he? He didn't say, yes, you will die if you approach me, my tabernacle, and my anointed ones improperly. He didn't say that. Instead, he simply turned to Aaron and began instructing him in just how anointed his anointed ones are. I think the people are finally starting to get the point. God no longer even wants to talk with them. Now, before we get into the importance of the priesthood, I want to just commiserate on the priesthood for a moment, because we tend to romanticize about being a part of God's priesthood. So let's take a look at some verses in the New Testament that talk about us as the priesthood. Let's go to chapter 2, verses 5 and 9. You also, as lively stones, are built up a spiritual house, a holy priesthood, to offer up spiritual sacrifices acceptable to God by Yeshua Messiah. But you are a chosen generation, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, a peculiar people, that you should show forth the praises of Him who has called you out of darkness into His marvelous light. Now let's go to Revelations 1, Revelations 5, and Revelations 20. Here's Revelations 1, verse 6. And has made us kings and priests to God and His Father. To Him be glory and dominion forever and ever. Amen. And Revelations 5, verse 10. And has made us unto our God kings and priests, and we shall reign on the earth. And in Revelation 20, verse 6, blessed and holy is he that has part in the first resurrection. On such the second death has no power, but they shall be priests of God and of Yeshua, and shall reign with him 1,000 years. And it's actually priests of God and of Messiah, and shall reign with him 1,000 years. So, we definitely will be priests for 1,000 years, and Peter says that right now we are priests. So this chapter really, really, really applies to us. So not much is said about what's going to happen after that 1,000-year reign as priests, so keep that in mind. But there are some things about being a priest that are romantic, and some things that are not. So, just what does it mean to be a priest? Well, this chapter is going to tell us. Chapter 18. Let's see what God said to Aaron, the priests, and the remaining Levites that he refused to tell the people. So to Aaron he says, the Lord said to Aaron, you and your sons and your father's house with you shall bear iniquity connected with the sanctuary, and you and your sons with you shall bear iniquity connected with your priesthood. See, that's not so romantic, is it? The tribe of Levi bears any and all iniquity that is connected to the sanctuary. That's because he says, you and your sons and your father's house. Who is the father of the house? Levi. Shall bear iniquity connected with the sanctuary. And we're going to stop and examine that right there. Now, what does it mean to bear something? Well, the Hebrew word there for to bear is nasa. It's Strong's 5375. And it means to lift, to carry. It means also to accept. Okay? So to bear something is to lift or carry it. Literally, the thing lifted is a burden. It's what we phrase today as, you bear the responsibility. You know, that's always a negative connotation. I've never heard that phrase used in a positive sense. Well, it's your responsibility always means if something goes wrong, it's your fault. And the whole tribe of Levi bears the fault for anything that goes wrong with the whole sanctuary. Now, I'm going to explain more about that in a little bit. And then we want to look at what is iniquity. Well, that's Strong's 5771, and the Hebrew word is avon. It means perversity, something that is perverse or evil, you know, false or even sin. It's literally talking about sin there, perversity. So the burden of the Levites, the burden that the Levites have to carry for the sanctuary or the holy place and the holy of holies, is the burden of sin. In other words, if something goes awry with the sanctuary or the holy place and holy of holies, if there is a sin, meaning inadvertent or deliberate disobedience to one of the commandments connected to the sanctuary, it will be deemed to be the fault of the entire tribe of Levi. They will all be responsible. Now, this raises the question, why would sin connected with the sanctuary have to do with the entire tribe? You know, it's only the priests that have anything to do with the sanctuary, right? Only they get to do service in there, right? No. Let me explain. Now, I'm sure you know this already, that all priests are Levites, but not all Levites are priests. However, the entire tribe, not just the priests, are responsible for the sanctuary and for keeping it holy because they all have tasks to do. Do you remember the teaching on Gershon, Kohath, and Gerari, who were given special tasks regarding the tabernacle? Let's go back to Numbers 3 and 4. Numbers 3:25. And the guard duty of the sons of Gershon in the tent of meeting involved the tabernacle, the tent with its covering, the screen for the entrance of the tent of meeting, and in Numbers 3:36, and the appointed guard duty of the sons of Merari involved the frames of the tabernacle, the bars, the pillars, the bases, and all their accessories, all the service connected with these. And in Numbers 4:4, this is the service of the sons of Kohath in the tent of meeting, the most holy things. Now, let's look at some of this lineage because this is important to understand how the priesthood was set up. Aaron was in Kohath's lineage by way of Kohath's son, Amram. In 1 Chronicles 6, verse 3, it says, "The children of Amram, Aaron, Moses, and Miriam, the sons of Aharon, Nadab, Abihu, Eleazar, and Itamar." So Aaron and Moses and Miriam were the children of Amram. But Amram was only one of the four sons of Kohath. 1 Chronicles 23:12 says the sons of Kohath, Amram, Izhar, Hebron, and Uziel. So God had been planning the line of Amram that came from Kohath to be his priests from the foundation of the earth. How do I know that? Well, it's because all of Aaron's cousins, you know, those that were not chosen for the priesthood, but who did come from Kohath or the other sons of Levi, they were one, Kohath was one of Levi's three sons. They were appointed to care for the holiest things of the sanctuary, even though they are not priests. That whole line of Kohath is related to the holiest things having to do with the sanctuary. But the special line of Aaron that came from Kohath do service using the holy things of the sanctuary, and Kohath was given the care of those holy things. Nonetheless, that whole line of Kohath is associated with the holiest things of the sanctuary, and I believe that God knew that right when he decided to make the earth, that Kohath was going to have a son by the name of Amram, and Amram was going to have Aaron, and Aaron's line was going to be chosen to be priests, and the rest of the Levites were going to be given other jobs. So, sins connected with the sanctuary were to be borne by the entire tribe of Levi. But sins stemming from the behavior of the priests, well, now that's another story. The priests' behavior, the priests' sins, were the responsibility of the priesthood only. The entire tribe of Levi did not bear any responsibility for any sins that the priests committed. So, if one of the priests sinned, only the priesthood bore responsibility for it. Now, this relates to us in the camps, and I'm going to explain how. Because, look, if one of us sins in the camps, you know, one of us who have been upholding Torah before the tribulation starts, you know, that is, we didn't just stumble out of Babylon and into one of the camps during the tribulation, you know. If one of us who knows better sins, we will all be held responsible. Why is that? Well, it's because the tribulation is a national punishment and time of atonement. It is associated with the fall feasts, and one of those feasts is Yom Kippur. It is the national day of atonement. On Yom Kippur, each individual bears responsibility for the sins of the entire nation. Some people don't understand that. But the, you know, Passover, the spring feast, that's all about our individual responsibility. The fall feasts are about our national responsibility. And we all bear the responsibility for the sins of the entire nation. Here's another way that I know that. Because Daniel fell on his face and asked for forgiveness for his nation. Now, if he didn't bear the personal responsibility for the sins of the entire nation, he would not have been able to do that. He would have had to just ask for forgiveness for his personal sins, and he would have had to leave it at that. So that's why on Yom Kippur, we pray for God to forgive our national sins. So, the brothers, when it talks about the brothers in here, means the other descendants of Levi. Now, those other descendants of Levi, Gershon, Merari, and Kohath, were to be ministers to the priests. Let's read what Numbers 18 says, starting in verse 2. And with you bring your brothers also, the tribe of Levi, the tribe of your father, that they may join you and minister to you while you and your sons with you are before the tent of the testimony. In other words, that job was for them to take care of all the other things that needed to be done so that the priests could do their job. And they shall keep guard over you and over the whole tent, but shall not come near to the vessels of the sanctuary or to the altar, lest they and you. Now, that excludes, of course, those times when those items have to be taken out and packed up and gotten ready to move. What this is talking about is when the priests are before the tent of testimony. That's a euphemism for when they are doing their priestly duty. Verse 4, they shall join you and keep guard over the tent of meeting for all the service of the tent, and no outsider shall come near you. You see, these other Levites are to be a protective force for the priests in order for them to be able to come before the Lord. And you shall keep guard over the sanctuary and over the altar, that there may never again be wrath on the people of Israel. Oh, now we're relating back to Korah, because Korah was going to violate his guard duty in the sanctuary and over the altar. And so this guard duty was then given to Aaron. God said to Aaron, he's been talking, you know, that he's talking to Aaron and he's been saying, they shall do this, they shall do that. Now he says in verse 5, and you, Aaron, shall keep guard over the sanctuary and over the altar. In other words, you know, the Levites, they're going to have guard over the tent of meeting, and they're going to guard you while you're doing the service. But ultimately, you are the one that is the guard over the sanctuary and over the altar, that there may never again be wrath on the people of Israel. And behold, or look, I have taken your brothers, the Levites, from among the people of Israel. They are a gift to you, given to the Lord to do the service of the tent of meeting. You see, God was laying it out. He was telling them what the hierarchy is, so that no one would be mistaken. Aaron has a place. The tribe of Levi has a place. The brothers, Gershon, Merari, and Kohath, they all have their duties. And that's what you're going to stick to. That's what the message here is. Now, everyone in the tribe of Levi who is not a priest is thus a gift to the priests and are to minister to them. They are to help them. Now, what does this mean for us in the camps? Well, if we find ourselves not in a position of leadership, even though we've been keeping Torah, we will still have a responsibility, which is to minister to and help those in leadership. Now, for some people, that's going to prove difficult. That is, unless they drop their adverse attitudes, which cause them to always have something to say about what the leadership is doing. You see, that's what Korah did. Instead of being happy to have been given the task of Kohath, which was the care and keeping of the holy things inside the holy place and the Holy of Holies, Korah decided that he was just going to set himself up as part of the priesthood. After all, he and Aaron were in the same line, and I'm sure that Korah was confused over why God would choose Amram's sons, Aaron and Moses, over his father's sons, the sons of Izhar. Surely God made a mistake. Well, no, God didn't make a mistake, and make no mistake about it. When we go through this process again in the truncated time allotted, you know, 42 months instead of 42 years, we will face Korah again, and he will rise up from among those who say, I kept Torah, why can't I be a leader? It would be better to get the Korah out of us now than to suffer being sucked into a sinkhole, which, by the way, is happening to people now. So get a clue. Not only are cars and houses being sucked into sinkholes now, but just this past week, 3 people died from being sucked under into a sinkhole. Expect to see more of this. But what's more, expect to see this in the camps during the tribulation. Numbers 18, verse 7. And you and your sons with you shall guard your priesthood, for all that concerns the altar and that is within the veil, and you shall serve. I give your priesthood as a gift, and any outsider who comes near shall be put to death. Ah, there's the answer to the question, and it is yes. If you even think about coming in here when you don't belong here, you will die. The priesthood is a gift to Aaron and his descendants. It was not for the other children of Kohath, or the other children of Gershon, or the children of Merari, or anyone from any of the other tribes. Numbers 18:8. Then the Lord spoke to Aaron, "Behold, I have given you charge of the contributions made to me, all the consecrated things of the people of Israel. I have given them to you as a portion and to your sons as a perpetual due." The priesthood is in charge of the money and other things that get donated and consecrated. Numbers 18, verse 9. This shall be yours of the most holy things, reserved from the fire. Every offering of theirs, every grain offering of theirs, and every sin offering of theirs, and every guilt offering of theirs, which they render to me, shall be most holy to you and to your sons. Those words of theirs means the assembly. The priests alone are to partake of the assembly's offerings. Now, the words of theirs are not really necessary to the translation, although those words in English are allowed per the rules of translation. The actual words there are kole korban, kole minka, kole katat, and kole asham. Kole means every. Korban is the oblation, minka is the voluntary offering, and katat is sin offering, and asham is trespass offering. So these are self-explanatory and don't require the use of the words of theirs. It's just added in there, although it's not italicized. The portion of these that the priests are to share with God from the altar are only to be shared among the priests, period. In Numbers 18:10 it says, "In a most holy place shall you eat it. Every male may eat it. It is holy to you." Well, it shouldn't be in a holy place. It should say in the holy place. Numbers 18:11. This also is yours, the contribution of their gift, all the wave offerings of the people of Israel. I have given them to you and to your sons and daughters with you as a perpetual due. Everyone who is clean in your house may eat it. Here we see what part of the offerings can be shared by the priests with their children, with the stipulation that they be clean. Of course, we know when the priests serve, they have to be clean, so it's not a matter of, you know, them being clean or unclean when they are partaking of the offerings, because they're clean. They don't serve if they're not clean. But if someone in the house is unclean, you know, like a young woman who may be in her nidah, or maybe, you know, of the son who may have touched something that isn't clean, that makes him unclean for that day, these folks cannot partake of any of those offerings that the priest may bring home to them. Numbers 18:12. All the best of the oil and all the best of the wine and of the grain, the first fruits of what they give to the Lord, I give to you. See, God gives all the best to his priests. Verse 13, the first ripe fruits of all that is in their land, which they bring to the Lord, shall be yours. Everyone who is clean in your house may eat it. Every devoted thing in Israel shall be yours. Everything that opens the womb of all flesh, whether man or beast, which they offer to the Lord, shall be yours. Nevertheless, the firstborn of man you shall redeem, and the firstborn of unclean animals you shall redeem. And their redemption price, at a month old you shall redeem them, you shall fix at 5 shekels in silver, according to the shekel of the sanctuary, which is 20 gerahs. But the firstborn of a cow, or the firstborn of a sheep, or the firstborn of a goat, you shall not redeem. They are holy. You shall sprinkle their blood on the altar, and shall burn their fat as a food offering, with a pleasing aroma to the Lord. Now, they didn't get to keep the human firstborn males that came from the womb. Why not? Well, it's because, I know that sounds silly, but you got to ask the question. What makes human males, human firstborn males, different than the firstborn males of other animals? Well, it's because humans cannot be used as a sacrifice for peace, thanksgiving, sin, or anything. That's because humans need to be atoned for, and they can't be sacrificed for their own sins or for the sins of anyone else. So God specified an atonement price for baby boys that must be observed. Now, clean animals, do not need to be redeemed, but humans do need to be redeemed. So the duty of the firstborn animals is to atone for humans. And firstborn animals are used because in God's kingdom, firstborns atone for firstborns. If you are a part of God's family, you are a firstborn. Why is the sacrificial system set up this way? Well, one reason is so that we humans will understand our proper relationship to creation and for the suffering that we have caused to all of creation. You know, it's kind of like when you're in the military and one of the members of your platoon messes up and the whole platoon has to do 50 push-ups. You know, God is trying to teach humans respect for His creation, by using it to atone for us. He's trying to teach us the suffering that we have caused. We know that one of the reasons that the tribulation is coming is because all of creation groans for deliverance because of what man has done to it. Romans 8:22 says, "For we know that the whole creation has been groaning together in the pains of childbirth until now." So, there's a lot of reasons why the Lord set up the sacrificial system that way. That's just one or two of the most minuscule, tiniest of reasons. But there's a whole lot of that for us to think about. Now, moving on, verse 18. "But their flesh shall be yours, as the breast that is waved and as the right thigh are yours. All the holy contributions that the people of Israel present to the Lord I give you, and to your sons and daughters with you, as a perpetual due. It is a covenant of salt forever before the Lord for you and for your offspring with you." I can tell you that the study of the covenant of salt is intensely interesting, and I don't have time to even begin to broach it, but if you want to do an interesting study, do a study on the covenant of salt. Most people don't even know that we have all these covenants that the Lord brings us into, and it's so wonderful how He just works so hard to keep us, close to Him with these covenants. Anyway, the fact that God does this means that God intends for the priests to be able to take care of their families too. But there is a price to pay for this. Let's look at verse 20. And the Lord said to Aaron, "You shall have no inheritance in their land, neither shall you have any portion among them. I am your portion and your inheritance among the people of Israel." So that's the price they pay. In order to be given this priesthood, they have to give up earthly inheritance. Their inheritance truly is spiritual. But now the picture changes, because now the language changes, because God is going to start talking about what he's given to the tribe of Levi. In verse 21, he says, "To the Levites, I have given every tithe in Israel for an inheritance in return for their service that they do, their service in the tent of meeting, so that the people of Israel do not come near the tent of meeting, lest they bear sin and die." See, they are responsible, the Levites are responsible for not letting the people come near the tent of meeting, and yet it was one of the Levites who rose up against another Levite and a priest at that, Aaron, and Moses, of course, who was specially anointed by God. This is why, you know, if you're a leader, you don't want to come up against another leader, especially. First, in verse 8, we read that the priests were in charge of all the contributions. Now, we read that the tithes, which are a contribution, are for the Levites who serve the priests, not the priests by themselves. So we're getting a little bit more definition here of exactly how God wants the priests to take care of the contributions that he gives them in verse 8. So we'll see in a minute what special amount that the priesthood gets from the tithes that belong to the tribe of Levi. And by the way, the tithes here are not the every 3 years tithe that is given to care for the widows, orphans, and the poor. You know, God has given specific instructions about that special tithe. This refers to that one regular one-tenth tithe that everybody has to give every year. In verse 23, it says, "But the Levites shall do the service of the tent of meeting, and they shall bear their iniquity. It shall be a perpetual statute throughout your generations, and among the people of Israel they shall have no inheritance." So, even though the entire tribe of Levi are not priests, nonetheless, they also do not get to inherit land in Israel. This is because they get the tithe. Verse 24, "For the tithe of the people of Israel, which they present as a contribution to the Lord, I have given to the Levites for an inheritance. Therefore I have said of them that they shall have no inheritance among the people of Israel." You see, it's because they get the tithe that they do not have an inheritance among the people of Israel. And the priesthood, the reason they don't get an inheritance among the people of Israel is because God has given them the gift of being the priests. So there's two different reasons for the Levites, depending on whether they're a priest or not a priest, for them to not have a portion of the land that's given to the people in the nation. Verse 25 and 26, "And the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, Moreover, you shall speak and say to the Levites, when you take from the people of Israel the tithe that I have given you from them for your inheritance, then you shall present a contribution from it to the Lord, a tithe of the tithe." Now, what this means is that the entire assembly is going to bring a one-tenth tithe of, you know, all the produce to the tribe of Levi. That one-tenth tithe is overseen by the priesthood, but the priests are going to get to keep one-tenth of that one-tenth. You know, one-tenth of that one-tenth tithe. In verse 27, and your contribution shall be counted to you as though it were the grain of the threshing floor and as the fullness of the winepress. So you shall also present a contribution to the Lord from all your tithes, which you receive from the people of Israel, and from it you shall give the Lord's contribution to Aaron the priest. So the tribe of Levi pays tithes on the tithes that it receives. Verse 29, out of all the gifts to you, you shall present every contribution to the Lord. From each its best part is to be dedicated. Therefore you shall say to them, when you have offered from it the best of it, then the rest shall be counted to the Levites as produce of the threshing floor and as produce of the winepress, and you may eat it in any place, you and your households, for it is your reward in return for your service in the tent of meeting. You shall bear no sin by reason of it when you have contributed the best of it, but you shall not profane the holy things of the people of Israel, lest you die. You see, what this Torah portion is really about is understanding the holiness of the priesthood, which is above and beyond the holiness of the Levites, which are holy themselves, but who are assigned to assist the priests. The whole assembly is called holy by God himself, but the Levites are holier than the assembly, and the priests are even holier than the Levite tribe. You see, it's all about hierarchy and who God chooses to fill those ranks. It's also about not complaining about it, not trying to undermine it, not trying to usurp it or do anything else about it. It's about us accepting and being content with the role that God gives us. And we all have a role to play. Just one more thing. I want to talk about tzitzit for a minute before I go. We read about the tzitzit in last week's Torah portion, and I want to point out something very important. What is one of the symbolic meanings of the almonds and the almond blossoms on the rod of Aaron in this Torah portion? You know, I didn't go over this because I wanted to spend time specifically on this chapter, but let's just take a quick look at the almonds and the almond blossoms and their connection to the tzitzit. In Numbers 15:38, we read, "Speak to the children of Israel and bid them to make fringes in the borders of their garments throughout their generations, and they put upon the fringe of the borders a ribbon of blue." Now, the King James uses the word fringes. It's Strong's 6734, and it's literally tzitzit. Now, let's go and look at its related word, which is tzitzit. I know it doesn't sound very different, but it is. Tzitzit means a floral or wing-like projection that is a forelock of hair, or a tassel, and we call a tassel a fringe or a lock. But so that is tzitzit. Okay. Now let's go look at tzitzit. Now, this is Strong 6731. See, tzitzit are 6734, and the word for blossom has the same root, and it's 6731. one. And so it means a blossom or a flower. Okay? So the almond blossom, the blossoms that were on Aaron's rod are related to the blossoms, to the fringe, to the lock, to the tassel. They're all related to the to each other here. They have the same root. So when you're wearing a tzitzit, you are declaring the blossoms that came forth on Aaron's rod. The tzitzit are a part of our uniform, and they identify us. I can't tell you the number of times that I've heard from people who say they have accidentally found other Hebrew roots brethren simply because they saw somebody wearing tzitzit and they went up to talk to them. But what's even more than that is that when we're in the camps and those Christians and other pagans start pouring in, how are they going to identify us as being leaders or leaders' assistants in the camps if we're not wearing the tzitzit? The tzitzit are going to be our identifiers. The 144,000 are going to be marked in their foreheads. You're going to know those guys. But those people who are not marked in their foreheads are going to need an identifier. And I'm kind of thinking that these tzitzit have been our identifiers down through the ages, but as we get into the tribulation, they're going to need to be our identifiers in the camps. So until next week, Shabbat Shalom.